This is an interview with Vaya Proyas, conducted by Ruth Munro on Tuesday, the 4th of July 2017, at the State Library of South Australia. The interview is being conducted as part of the Women's Information Service History Project. Also present at the interview is Anna Lynch, who is operating the recording equipment. In the interview, the Women's Information Service and its earlier name of Women's Information Switchboard will be referred to by the acronym WIS. Right, I'll begin the interview by asking for some personal information. First of all, can you tell me your name?
My name is Vaya Proyas.
And where and when were you born and where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Greece in a small village up in the mountains in the north. In 1957, my mother said I was born at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. My family migrated to Australia. My father came first in 1960, and my mother, my brother and I followed on the boat, the Patrice, through the Suez Canal in 1961. And we lived basically around the Fruville Parkside area, and that's where I grew up and went to school.
Right. Thank you for that. And how did you come to be working at WIS, which was, I believe, the Women's Information Switchboard at that time?
Well, I knew about WIS a lot because I was very active in the Women's Liberation Movement. And I remember being at a collective meeting when Deborah McCulloch came to talk about this exciting new initiative that the Labor government was going to fund, which is a Women's Information Switchboard. Where women could get information, and it was going to be new and in a nice location with some paid staff but also involving volunteers. I didn't realise that come 1994 I would be working there as the acting coordinator.
Right, so you started there in 1994 and you were the acting coordinator. How long were you there as acting coordinator?
I had a stint there for 10 months. And it was a filler-in position because the previous coordinator had left and there were big changes underway and they wanted to bed down those changes before advertising for a coordinator.
Right, and where was WIS located then?
We were in Kintore Avenue in the lovely library building there. It was one big open room and there was an office that for the coordinator that I sat in and a sort of half an office for the administrator and another half a kind of office, a partitioned office, which had our photocopier and things.
And can you tell me what WIS was like when you started there? What were its aims and objectives and how did it operate?
Well, it was there to empower women through information and also to support women in whichever ways that they needed support. And by the time I got there, WIS was about 16 or 17 years old, and it had been in the same location, operating 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And it had pamphlets, which was the first way that we gave women information, and the telephone. So women didn't have to come in, they could ring in at any time and get information. They had just newly put in some computers, so all of the paper documents that they had and information could be loaded onto the computer and you could search, anyone taking a call could search on the issue or the location, many ways to access the information. It was a very large database. It had moved from cards to onto the computer.
That's very interesting. In the days of the internet now, to think of how you got the information back then.
And that was before the email. There were no email or internet pages or internet access at WIS at that point.
And how many staff and volunteers were there?
I think we had a core group of some 15, 20 volunteers. There were six staff. There were six information officers and an office administrator and the coordinator. We had, the staff all had various roles. We had four cultural, bicultural staff, bilingual staff. We had a staff member responsible for supporting volunteers and the volunteer training program. Our bicultural staff had very busy lives. They were running radio programs every week, attending community meetings. I think I talked about that it was open 12 hours a day, so actually we had shift workers. All of the staff worked shifts. So there was the 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. shift and the 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. shift, and on weekends as well. So there were very few times when everyone was together. And when I went there, that struck me first off, that people weren't wonderful women doing what they could, but they weren't working as a team. And partly that's because they were never ever there at the same time. And I do remember just the difficulties in even holding staff meetings. So I used to try to incorporate some fun, a shared lunch or something, to make those times when we came together very special.
Right.
The other thing is that what I'd been told by staff, and I experienced it while I was there, is that the numbers of calls were dropping, the complexity of the calls were increasing, people requiring a lot more support. And although we had a steady walk-in wasn't, there weren't that many people that walked in to the place.
Do you think that was because they didn't know about it? Or?
Possibly two things, or perhaps they didn't come to the city very often. And I think that's, which is why the telephone service was so important, more important in a sense than location, because, you know, not a lot of people come into the city. I should say too that this was now 1994-95 that I'm talking about, and a lot had happened around Adelaide. There were a lot more information services. Mm. We had Seniors Line, there was an information service at Marion, there was one at Salisbury. A lot of them were run along the same lines, which is there to support, give information was power, to empower local people. A lot of women were involved in those services, so women from the community could go there and get the same sort of support. So it was a very different environment in the 90s. And what struck me about that time is that it was a transition time for WIS too. It had done what it had done so well. It had a wonderful reputation. It had steady supporters. Some of the volunteers had been there since day one, and they kept staying and coming every week to their shifts. So that shows you the kind of support that it had amongst the women's groups.
Right, and what changes were introduced to WIS while you were there as coordinator?
So I tried to revitalise some of our, to re-energise the staff and the volunteers. So we updated the volunteer training program. We had an active recruitment to get new volunteers. The training program, as I said, was much improved. We got different staff and other people from outside to come in to do sessions. We gave people a certificate at the end so that they had something to show for that. And they got to work with, I involved the other volunteers in training the new volunteers. And I think that worked really well. At that same time, we started a conversation about, well, what should the core business be now of WIS, given the changing circumstances that we found ourselves in? Those changing circumstances, though, meant that women still needed support. Don't get me wrong, that didn't change. But how do we support people? How do we work with others who are supporting women? Those questions. So we had a kind of planning process that took stock of who else was around and how could we, what place did we have therefore in this new community landscape. And that meant things that looking at what were the volunteers doing, what were the staff doing, what did they think of each other. And one of the changes that arose as a result of that was that we asked the bicultural workers to start to move away from the weekly commitment of a radio program and to train up volunteers, women in the community who had a passion for radio and communication so that they could run the radio program and we could continue to provide them with updated information. We could give them ideas of topics, guest speakers that they could bring in and play that kind of a role rather than the front role.
Right. So it sounds like there was a lot of changes happening during the time you were there. So you were acting coordinator from May 1994 to March 1995.
Yes.
And what did you do after that?
The Women's Information Switchboard was part of the Women's Office, which had a Women's Advisor to the Premier, and the unit was called the Women's Information and Policy Unit, and it sat in the Department of the Premier and Cabinet, right at the heart, the top of the public sector. So I started there in our policy wing. I had those wonderful 10 months in the actual WIS itself, and then I went to Sydney to work at the Redfern Legal Centre to do a project, and on my return 3 months later, I resumed my role in what was the women's unit, which was then called the Office for the Status of Women. So at the end of 93, after the election and of new government came in, and we had a new minister, Diana Laidlaw, and the Office for the Status of Women, rather than reporting to the Premier, reported to our minister. And the office was relocated to be close to the minister. She was also the Minister for Transport, the Arts, and later Planning, I think. So very diverse portfolios, and she wanted her Office for the Status of Women close by. And so we moved out of Victoria Square, where we'd been, and over to the Station Arcade building, which the minister later renamed Dame Roma Mitchell in honour of the governor as she was at the time. And I basically worked there through to about 2001. So in reflecting my 8 years in this area, I actually had a different relationship with WIS, but I maintained my interest and involvement in WIS.
And what was your role then in regard to WIS?
So we undertook, again, a review of the whole women's portfolio, which at that time had the women WIS, it had the policy unit, and it also had a newly established South Australian Women's Advisory Council. So there were the three prongs to the government's resources to the women's portfolio. And we wanted to work better together rather than separately and for each of us to inform the other. So one of the things that WIS did is they kept statistics on the calls or the people who contacted, women who contacted, and what it was about. And so we wanted to have a way to feed that into the policy wing. Therefore, what could we do in a systemic way across government to meet these concerns? And interestingly, technology was just starting to take off in the 90s, and it emerged as an issue for women. And we were concerned that we didn't want women to be left behind in this sort of race for technology. And so we looked at some policies and procedures and things that we advise government about, but there were also very practical things that we could do. And the Women's Information Service was a wonderful service vehicle for, we would look at trends and the impact on women of change, and the Women's Information Service, as it was then called, and was relocated. We haven't talked about that, but one of the things we did is move them closer to us. So we're all in the same building, albeit they were in a shopfront, right at the heart of the city, not tucked away, but right there at the Station Arcade, close to the Adelaide Railway Station. It was prime location. And they ran services and found ways to reach women. I can remember two what I think were wonderful, innovative, you know, I think we were the first to do it. And one was One was actually email addresses. So I think at the time we didn't even have an email address. Maybe we were all starting, and we may have had one to share for the whole office had one to share. But it was the new way to communicate. You could communicate with people across the world. For our people here from other countries, they could communicate with their families. And so there was a concerted campaign, really, to let women establish an email address. They were free. And so I don't know how many women got their first email address through the Women's Information Service. But I recall this beautiful, beautiful lady whose name I can't remember. She was in her early 80s. She lived at Gawler. She used to catch the train in, and she would come in and use, because we had some computers that any woman could come in and use, and go in there and communicate with her grandchildren, who were all doing fabulous things across Australia and across the world. And I remember how, for her in her 80s, she was right in there with the latest technology. And we used to, our Vietnamese worker, Lian, used to bring women in on, Vietnamese women in on the weekend, on Saturdays when we were open, and she could train the women in how to use computers, how to access the internet, how to establish email, how to use email. So that was really exciting. It was geared towards older women, women without computers at home, and women from other cultures. Our young women were already using it, you know. They didn't kind of need that service quite as much, although we did have computers that they could come in and use and find their own information or make their own arrangements. The other one that I'd like to talk about was actually, at that time, banking had changed. And so people were moving away from having their cards, you know, their books, their deposit books, and the card was coming in. And the best way to use the card, obviously, you could use it anywhere, at any ATM machine. You could use it night and day. It liberated people. It meant that you could have access your money when you wanted it, not within the working day hours of the bank. But a lot of women said they were very nervous about using it. What if they lost it? What if they moved the wrong money? What if whatever? And we were discussing this with the minister, Di Laidlaw, and she said, well, why don't you get one in? Get an ATM in and run classes. And then it was like, gosh, where do you get an ATM from? And we got one through People's Choice, which was our credit union. And they were very excited about this program to teach women in a safe place, one-on-one. It didn't matter if they made mistakes, you know, nobody could see them. And they could learn it. And that's what we did. They lent us an ATM machine, and we had it sitting in the shop front, and women booked in, or if they were visiting, they came in and learnt to use it. What we did was, that was great, and that sort of introduced a whole new group of women to the service. And then we were able to negotiate with the key banks. By that stage, a lot of the key banks had like women officers to look at women's businesses, and we convinced them that this is something they should be doing. And so they did. So that was a kind of revolution across Adelaide, really, that the banks themselves would have a bank officer available at an ATM inside the bank so anyone who banked with them could learn, and they could move to a key card. My own mother got a key card and learnt how to use it. So, and you know, she was a Greek lady who didn't speak much English. But so.
What a wonderful idea to teach them there. And what about learning the internet for the older women? Was there a program to help them
there? There was a program. I should talk about how did the WIS used to operate by having kind of two functions. There was the telephone function, and we had that in a back room in the shop front, because it, you know, you needed some quiet, so that's why that was there. The main shop front had a series of computers, and we would anyone could walk in at any time because we always had rostered staff and volunteers, and they could be taught. They could also book in if they were only going to be in town at a particular time. And that probably was one of the busiest services. I talked earlier about when we were over on Kintore Avenue, our statistics showed people accessed us mainly, or women accessed, mainly through the telephone. When we got to the shop front, I think actually our walk-ins were really high. In fact, I don't know, they may have even surpassed the phones at some stage. Our walk-ins changed, the stats changed, because the other thing that we did is we did regional and local visits. So we would go out to regions. We often went with the transport people. They had a kind of bus that went around to regional areas and people could come in and pay their driver's license or whatever, SA water, you know, all those kind of bills. And we would go along too and have, because they had internet access, and we would teach women how to use the internet and access and how to find information for themselves in regional locations. We also did shopping centres, and we had a series of advertisements which would pose some questions, you know, are you interested in this? Have you ever wondered about that? Hey, someone's going to be in your local shopping centre at this day, these times, come in. So that those were, so the telephone became the less way, and it was kind of face-to-face, internet, email became the new way. But again, that I presume that's increased a lot since I was involved, yeah.
And so at the actual shop front, did you have a program to teach?
Yes, we did. Yeah. Yes, we did. And as I said, people could either come in and run through the program or book a time to have a time with a trainer, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay. And did the hours change when you moved to the station arcade?
So one of the things we started to do, I talked about in the early days, there hadn't been a lot of investment in WIS. And so part of the investment was having a review and looking at what services, what the usage was, when were the core busy times, so that we could make sure we had more staff on then and look at it. And it showed pretty much that the sort of after 6, 7 o'clock, phone calls dropped right off. And the kind of calls that came in were really calls where I think a service like Lifeline was probably had better support and trained people to be able to offer them. So there was a huge consultation process because WIS is owned by a lot of people. It's not just the staff or even the volunteers. All the women's groups that over the years have supported WIS, and there was a WIS support group, which was always a bipartisan group. It had women from all the political parties, every women's group, the Girl Guides, I mean, so many women's groups. So it was kind of owned by a lot of people, and everyone loves WIS and loved WIS and had a, and needed to have a say. And it wasn't an easy process. I think sometimes you've fought to defend a place. You kind of don't want to see change, but the facts kind of spoke for themselves. And also we wanted to be able to use our resources differently because the times had changed and we needed to kind of go with them too so that we could make sure women weren't left behind. So we did change the times when we moved to the shop front. We were open 6 days a week and we were open from 9 o'clock to 6 o'clock, I think, initially. And on Saturdays, it was probably 9 or 10 through to about 4 or 5. And that really was, I don't think it was a bad thing. And I think that our statistics showed that we weren't suffering by having the less hours. It meant the staff, we didn't have to have so much shift work. It meant people could work together as a team. But it was a painful process, I have to say that. Yeah. As I said, I hope we heard everyone. There were written submissions, there were meetings to discuss. I hope everyone's voice was heard, but in the end, you know, you've got to make decisions on resources, and those were made.
And did you establish a website at that time?
Yes. So I talked about when the whole women's area, the three prongs, the three W's as we called them, the WIS, the women's policy and the women's advisory. And we had a kind of joint letterhead, which was three W's, very flowing W's, and each with its own colour. And the website reflected that too. So the page on the Women's Advisory Council had a page, and it talked about it did massive consultations across the state, and it became the new way to share information. So I talked about we started with info on cards, we moved into a database, and then it was beyond the database. It was frequently asked questions. It was alerting women to things that were coming up or issues that were starting to emerge, links to other sites, other women's sites, both here internationally. I think we wanted a presence because we didn't want to be left behind. And it was a challenge to find how can we get our information across. And also, but how can we empower women to seek their own information? How can we make it easier for them so that they don't need us, but they still can use the tools? And I think that one is still a challenge for today, because today is different to then, and tomorrow will be different again. So whoever are the custodians of the resource called WIS need to make sure that they are good advocates for women and make things easier for women.
So having the internet did change quite a lot the way that the workers and volunteers provided information to the clients. Did you have brochures?
We still had brochures, we did, but they were less reliable because as soon as you printed them, they were out of date. And I don't think phone numbers change that much, but it's really surprising how the services change. And so I think brochures are lovely, but they became a little bit superfluous. But we did have a very small display, really.
Mm. Yeah. So it did change it quite a lot.
It wasn't quite the main way to give people information.
No.
And the other, I talked about our bilingual. And with bilingual, it was just easier to find websites where people could get that information in their own language.
And
it just opened a new world.
Yes, it would have changed.
And the beauty is our beautiful volunteers, some of who had been there from day one and who were quite elderly but still coming, they all learnt it too. And it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
And who were the WIS coordinators during this time?
Okay, so there was Gudrun who left, and then me who came on. Margaret Porter was there, Linda Forrest, and Linda was probably there. Margaret was there for the move, the relocation. She did a wonderful job of making sure that the new WIS was so visually very beautiful. It worked with a lovely woman designer, and we had not very much money at all. Luckily, Diana Laidlaw had found some money for us. And so our lovely designer, Maria Gianquitto from Hassels, she used beautiful silk fabrics and lighting, and we managed to get some, I think they were donated actually, beautiful glassware from sort of jam factory, and we had little spots for them to sit. So, and lots of colours, beautiful colours. So visually it was very beautiful. I found it very beautiful and very inviting, and it showed. I think most people came in and went, wow. And the idea being, well, women deserve to be in a very restful, calm, safe place. One of the biggest challenges was the amount of window space. So it was a shop front, so of course that's all window. And people found it they weren't used to being exposed and on show because Kintore Avenue was tucked away. You know, nobody ever saw you. And it took some getting used to. Initially, people put screens and pamphlet stands and things just to try to get, I don't know, feel less exposed. But by the end, no. I think people saw that it's actually quite good to be exposed, to have that level of visibility, because so many women just came in saying, we didn't know what this was. And, you know, it was wonderful.
Oh, that sounds really good. Good move and good setup. And did you work with anyone else in the policy unit who had an impact on WIS?
Yeah, I did. In fact, all of the areas had so much overlap, obviously, because we were the one family, so to speak. So, for example, when I started work in the policy unit, Jane Taylor was the last women's advisor to the Premier. And when she left, Linda Matthews came on as acting director to set up the new office and reorient it towards the minister. And of course, Linda had been a WIS coordinator. So there was that connection. And then I said the minister wanted her office to be close to her. She created a position called the Director of the Office for the Status of Women. It was advertised and Kamo O'Loughlin won that position. Again, a previous WIS coordinator. So we kind of had a lot of crossover, and women who had started in WIS had gone on to do other things and then brought them back through the Women's Policy Office. So it was kind of exciting.
So you all worked in together in various roles.
People brought different knowledge and experience to the table. And as I said, the women's movement had experienced a lot of changes. I mean, a lot of what we were fighting for in the 70s, we got. We got women's health centres. We got women's offices in various departments and in the union movement. The banks had women, people just specifically looking after women customers. I mean, that was a big thing that we wanted. All of the agencies of government and firms to see women as customers, because, you know, previously we weren't allowed to be customers because we weren't allowed to have bank accounts or loans. Well, that had changed. And so, yeah, it was a different world. And that's why I think we felt we had to be one step ahead always and not rest on our laurels, but keep going.
Mm-hmm. And what memories do you have of the times you shared with other workers and volunteers during your time at WIS? You've talked about some of them, but is there anything else that you'd like to talk about?
I kind of think that I'm a pretty out there kind of person. And I think that probably was quite good for that transition period where people weren't sure what would happen. So we had a new minister, a new government, change was going to come. I think a lot of the staff had been, and volunteers had been, waiting for something to happen and had been a bit dispirited. So, as I said, I'm a firm believer in people working together and really sharpening their own thinking and making sure that we all knew what the contribution was that we wanted to make. I'm also a very social person, so I did kind of try to get staff to stay behind as soon as at 5 o'clock and stay and have a talk and a debrief and have a drink and to sort of just unwind a bit. Staff often had really difficult phone calls and not many opportunities to debrief, and to learn from each other and to share the day and what had happened. So that was, I think I did introduce a bit of that. But the other thing is just reconnecting with why we're here. What is it that we're here to do? And to be very conscious about that and make sure that our direction, our policies, our procedures, our rosters, how we conducted ourselves, our values, that everything was aligned so that we could be more effective. So that's, so my memory is really of some people perhaps weren't so keen on change, but I think at the end of the day, everyone pulled together as we always have, and made sure that the next phase, you know, was successful and they were on board. And people who didn't want to be on board left graciously, actually, not with bitterness, but left graciously to allow the new people to come through. The volunteers, because we had such long shifts and we were open so long, we always had to have a pool of casual staff to come in if staff were on sick leave or running one of the regional consultations. And we managed to get opportunities for many of those women to be employed as WIS workers. So we had a lovely breed, new, refreshing of staff through our volunteers, through our casual pool. And that's a real strength, I think. I worked with some gorgeous women. I can't believe how lucky I was to be there. And I look with such pride now when I see, I read about them in the newspapers, like Tanya Hosh, the AFL, footy league diversity person. Wow, she was a wonderful young WIS worker, and she acknowledges WIS, which is really great. And I look at many of our people that have gone into the public service proper, and they're running amazing programs in transport with the Northern Connector and disability services. So you'll find there are WIS people everywhere. I did a little straw count when I was there in 95, and I figured we'd had something like close to 1,000 volunteers, WIS support group people just in that, in, well, since 1977 or whenever it opened. So yeah, it was an important place. And it's done, I think it's done the public service a huge service by having people who are customer focused. Because I don't think the public service was very customer focused before that.
Right. Now, I think you've probably talked about, the next question was, do you want to talk about any other women who made an important contribution to WIS during your time there?
Well, I've mentioned some. So in my time, I think that we were very lucky to have Diana Laidlaw as our minister. Previous to that, we had the wonderful Anne Levy, and she was an incredible minister. She was also the Minister for the Arts. And then Diana came in, and she managed to increase our budget and give us the money to relocate, give us the money to buy new computers. So gave us great ideas of things, and also was very can-do. If you think that's a problem, just go out and do it. So that's pretty good. We had Carmel O'Loughlin. I just want to really mention her here because Carmel was an extraordinary person. Her knowledge of the women's area, women's through women's liberation, women's electoral lobby, through WIS, her work in domestic violence. She was the perfect person to be the director during this change period. And she was always true. I think her passion for women has never changed. And she was an extraordinary leader. She was wonderful for me. She gave me lots of opportunities, lots of support. And I just loved, we used to work around a table similar to how we're sitting now, and we'd edit beautiful publications and just changing the way that we produce stuff to make sure that we had case studies highlighting women, we had photographs of real women. It was just nice. Yeah, it was a beautiful time, really.
All right, we might just pause for a minute. We might move on to talk about the clients. What do you remember about the clients who used WIS, for example, age or ethnic background, and what involvement did you have with these women?
When I was at WIS, the client group was mainly through phone, and so I think we had a real mixture of women who would call. I think some of the issues were obviously domestic violence. Some of the issues were poverty, seeking financial assistance and relief, which is one of the reasons why we reoriented that to financial independence and women being able to understand that more. There weren't many clients who came in. We had our regulars who would come, I think, just to take the weight off their shoulders and just to have a sit down. And we also had some, occasionally we had some very angry men who came to the service. I can recall a very unpleasant fellow that came in, and I had to bring him into my office actually to calm him down and give the staff and the volunteers some reprieve. I don't know if that was very smart, because what I know now is I probably should have sat him. I should have sat closer to the door, but anyway. We had a varied clientele. It reflected the staff, so because we had a Greek speaker, a Spanish speaker, a Vietnamese speaker. We had large groups of women from those cultural groups who would call, and also who would volunteer in the radio programs. I think we had a younger group too, who were used to coming to look through our database to get information for themselves. I think it's probably changed now. I'm not even sure that we profile very much now the client. We tended to mainly profile the issue. And that was because we needed to make sure that if we saw a pattern of requests for certain information, we would do some research to make sure we had what they needed and that it was on our database. We had some unusual, I don't want to downplay it. I mean, the hard issues are hard issues. I recall we had quite a few grandmothers calling because they were concerned about, you know, their children were divorcing and they were concerned about the grandchildren and what they could find out. And, you know, luckily the federal courts used to produce very good booklets for children to help them to understand what mum and dad were going through. We had unusual requests. I'll never forget the lady from Kangaroo Island who, I don't know why, but she needed to locate some lucerne for her cows, and guess what? We found it for her. There are often requests for how do you get red wine out of suede, and we had resource books, and we had one which was about cleaning products, so our staff and volunteers could go to that and read out the excerpt. People often wanted to know about the bilby, the chocolate bilby, so we had a fact sheet on the bilby, where to get, just unusual calls as well as heartbreaking calls. We had quite a few immigration calls. A lot of our non-English speaking wanted to know how they could sponsor relatives to come out to Australia. Our multicultural workers were amazing, that they knew a little bit about everything because they had to kind of field every inquiry from their community.
And do you think that the type of women who use WIS has changed much over the years, and in what way?
I don't know if I can even answer that. I suspect that WIS still has clients of people who don't know where else to go, you know, for whatever their problem is. I think that they, because of the reputation of WIS, I think that it's a caring organisation and who will listen to whatever it is. That reputation will mean that people who are at the end of their tether or in despair will go there because they know they'll get a good hearing and some assistance. I suspect also it's people who want to access our knowledge base. It could be other service providers, other community group leaders who want to access some of that, because I think it's a very valuable resource. And then there are people who I think just want the information. They might get that from our internet page rather than even contact us. Don't want to contact us, just want to use our information. One of the other kind of, they're not really clients, was like the WIS support group. I think all the women's services and the various women's groups that are around. The WIS support group was such an important group. It saw itself as the sort of political wing to sort of protect and extend, I suppose, women's services and to always make sure that there were women-specific services in whatever area. So that was a very important group. That was, as I said earlier, it was a bipartisan group. There were women from the Liberal Party, the Australian Democrats, the Labor Party. It was a very well supported, and WIS had actually, to its credit, it had the view of actually being for all women, so not being judgmental about that. And sometimes it's easier to be judgmental and to forget, and I think the support group always reminded us that actually it's about all women and we don't judge. So and including, you know, we who think we're feminists, we don't judge about women who aren't feminists or who's, yeah. So that was really but again, as the coordinator, you don't actually do a lot of client work. I used to like to take calls because I never liked to hear a ringing phone. And occasionally I got to take some of those calls, and I was so pleased that we had a great database which you could interrogate and get the information, you know, give them local information. Hey, did you know that just, you know, near you there's this place and it's running this course that you may meet other people to who are in the same situation as you. So that was great.
And during your time at WIS, you might have talked about this, what were the important women's issues of the day and were they reflected in the kind of calls WIS received?
Well, unfortunately, you know, violence against women was as important then as it is today. So and I said earlier, it was also kind of women having no money and not knowing where to go. We used to have some particular kind of special information, and one was if a woman had decided that she wanted to leave, we had a kind of checklist that we could run through with her if she had made that decision, as well as putting her in touch with all of the domestic violence services and people who could help her. I recall at one stage what to do with your pet if you were leaving was kind of really important, and I think we actually wrote that in to the checklist and managed to find a service that would take care of the pet in the short term while they found new accommodation. So that and not having money, the usual relationship breakups and what to do. We certainly, those calls were there. There are also people who were depressed, not coping. Those calls were certainly there as well. I presume they are the calls of today.
Yes.
And
next question was going to be, do you think there is still a need for an information service for women today?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But the thing that I learned is that you don't have to provide the service directly yourself to be to make a difference. In fact, our relationships with other service providers, it's about where are the people, meeting them where they are and making sure that wherever they go to get help and support, that if we're holding information, we need to share it with those services so that the client, wherever the woman goes, she'll get the right information and be put in touch with the right services. So I do think that we will always be needed because we have to be the advocates, and someone has to keep the information alive and also make sure that it's being shared. You know, it's not about hanging on to it. We're not selling it. You know, we're giving it away. And also I do believe that we should go out to where the women are. They shouldn't have to come to us, really, which is why the telephone and the internet are great. It means you can access from wherever you are. And at any time, Well, the internet at any time, not the phone, there won't be someone to answer it. And I didn't talk earlier, actually, but I want to mention now that we did run all these other services. So the lesbian line was really important. They had a roster, the collective that ran that line, and it was on Tuesday nights from memory, and they would come in, volunteers would be rostered and come in and staff that line and take those calls. And they had their own information database of services and activities and events. And the other was legal advice. Excuse me. So we offered legal advice, telephone legal advice service, one evening a week and on Saturdays. And there were a whole bunch of wonderful women lawyers who gave their time. And I recall one, Dee Jesenew, said that she often was in the garden and had her telephone and would take the calls while she was sitting in her garden and giving women some early advice and certainly where to go next and how to access it. And in fact, Vicky Chapman, an MP, was one of the women who lawyers who gave her services. So we talked about clients, but also there's this huge range of volunteers who also sustained that service.
Mm. Yes, I was going to talk about within the community next, but you've covered a fair bit of that. WIS has been involved in providing services to women in the community over a long period of time. Mm. For example, outreach services like rural outreach,
yep,
attendance at field days, and talks to community groups. Now, I think you mentioned the van that went out in mm-hmm. the earlier days mm-hmm. to the rural areas. Is there any other outreach services that you had involvement with that you'd like to talk about?
I think those were probably the main ones from memory. We were often called upon to come and talk at community groups and women's groups, and all the staff took their turn to go and do what we would call the WIS talk. We went to a lot of schools, we went to a lot of to universities, to women's studies courses. Our public speaking was actually quite a big service that we provided. We often were interviewed on radio. In fact, Bob Francis went on his radio program. He was a great supporter of WIS. Who would have thought? And many a time on his talkback, if there was someone, he'd say, "Go and see the women at WIS. They will help you." He was tremendous.
That's
and
wonderful.
We often go, I know. Who would have thought? But one of his producers actually was a volunteer, the famous Tuesday group, which they were long-term volunteers, that group. So, yeah, no, it worked in mysterious ways. But, yes, no, I've forgotten about the public speaking, actually. It was big. We were invited to a lot of groups. Yeah. And after the changes, when it became the service and there was this new orientation to, internet, women's financial security, understanding the superannuation. We talked about the age groups. Well, actually, that was probably how we got some of the younger women accessing our services who had started work and were concerned about those things. We enterprise bargaining. We did quite a bit of work with the Working Women's Centre, which for one period of time actually located to the Station Arcade upstairs. And in fact, Sandra Dan, the director of the Working Women's Centre, came for, I'm not sure, was it 6 months or 12 months, and was the acting WIS coordinator when the coordinator at the time went off to do another little job somewhere. So, working women tended to go to the Working Women's Centre, and we had a reciprocal relationship with that service, and they were certainly members of the WIS support group, so we would work together when we needed to, but we also referred people to them and they referred to us.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, the working together of the women's services is great. Now, I think that's just about the end of my questions, but one more. How did your time at WIS, or the Office for Status of Women, influence or lead you to your next career move?
Well, I became interested in how can we change the current and how can we make services better. So for me, I then went to work on a couple of reviews of government services. One was a review of the public sector itself, and the other was the generational health review. And so I think my interest in the women's areas, I got to see a bit of everything across government, as you do with women's programs, and I got interested really in how can we make other services and programs that the government funds better and make sure that it's meeting the needs of its customers. WIS taught me to, the other thing WIS taught me to do is to be very bold and brave and to actually imagine a better world and get out there and sort of demand it. So I think my confidence grew a lot. And I learned, the other thing I learned is that you have to do it together. You've got to find ways to work together, otherwise things won't happen. And I say to my staff now, we spend so much time together. We spend more time together with each other as a team than we do with our friends. So we have to, you know, capitalise on that. So it did, it taught me to, well, I think the social justice, will, that's stronger now maybe than even then, and it was pretty strong in the old days, and getting rid of discrimination and injustice, absolutely, you know. I'm of that generation that thinks that you should fight for those things.
Right, and finally, is there anything you would like to add to what you have already said?
No, but it's wonderful. I think the project is wonderful. I think you two women are extraordinary, and you forget your memories. The social memory is important, and I'm really pleased to be part of this. Thank you very much. And I think it's great work. And if we can capture some of the energy and enthusiasm and have that on show for the next generations, I think that's great.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your memories. It's been wonderful.